Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. The book, It Came to Earth at Aztec, New Mexico, revealed the recovery of a UFO, coming out this fall. I interviewed Scott and Suzanne Ramsey in 2016, prior to the big watershed moment, the article at the New York Times that said the military acknowledges the existence of UFOs. It basically said UFOs are real. So going back to this case, 1948, the Aztec UFO case. Contrary to what's posted on Wikipedia, it's not a hoax. Their research includes pre-crash sightings by police and the military, witnesses, physical evidence, a total of up to 16 dead beings, and the scientists that worked on the craft. Bigger than Roswell? You bet. Here's our interview. 1948, the Aztec UFO case.
Other employees have gotten there first saying, hey, look, the brush fire is way up on top of the mesa. It looks like a lightning strike. No danger at all to the drip tanks, but you need to come up there because there's something very fantastic laying up on the mesa. And they get up there, and this very large object, approximately 100 feet across, is laying at an angle on the mesa. And it's, as they described it to me, a lenticular disc, very thin cross-section, very large craft.
The Aztec UFO incident. This kind of story requires someone who is obsessed. And there are two someones, at least, talking with Scott Ramsey and Suzanne Ramsey. This is a heck of a lot of work that you've done for this book.
I tell you what, it's been a long journey. Scott's been at it for 30 years, and I've been at it for 13 years. It has been a journey, but it has been a lot of fun. There's heartbreak, too, let me tell you, from time to time. We both own businesses, and we own a small hobby farm. And then on top of that, we do this. So we like to keep going all the time. So
for anyone who doesn't know, the Aztec UFO incident was first put out by the guy that Mulder is named.
Scully.
Scully. X-Files. Get my characters right here. The Aztec UFO incident, the first guy who wrote the book on it, they said that he was basically the victim of a hoax. He actually was a journalist, and there would be have been no reason for him to think that any of his information, if he did his due diligence, like most journalists try to do, he would have tried to have vetted his sources and in some way, shape, or form have some kind of documentation to back him up. Now, you guys, in doing your work, have managed to find a little bit of that. Somehow, it never came forward earlier, and I think people were frightened away because when you get into the bones of this story, there's a little intimidation factor that makes one wonder why you took it on and you're still here. Does that make sense? Is that a good question?
Yeah. let me comment on something that you said just a second ago about Frank Scully. Frank Scully was a journalist. He was missing a lung and a leg, and he still traveled all over the world and made a living, paid for all of his medical bills, and he had a very large family, and he made a living off of writing. Most of it was not creative writing. It was either biographies. People respected him so much that they would go to him to either ghostwrite or help to write their biographies. Now, I got to tell you, if that were me, I'd want to have someone that I could trust. In my research of Frank Scully, what I found is that routinely, when somebody was in trouble or having problems or needed help, whether they were a famous person or someone that was a neighbor down the street, the Scullys would take them in and care for them. And they were able to keep secrets and were respectful in that way far more than most people. The difference with the Aztec incident, different than any other incident that we know of, we were able to go in and find and document from the pre-crash sightings, the police officer following it up to the crash, the crash landing, and then the scientists that worked on it, and then the cover-up. And I use that term very specifically because cover-ups, that term conspiracy, honestly, it seems like to me that a lot of times those words get overused, and so they become diluted in their definition. In this case, they are absolutely true. And as you said, people were intimidated by these hoaxes and by the hoax and the cover-up. And it's an incredible story how we were able to, I say we, but it really, it's almost like a gift. Bit by bit, these pieces of information came to us, and we were able to document and follow through and find out how this came about. You know, and you mentioned how were we able to stay with it so long. You know, Scott, of course, has been with it the longest, and Frank Thayer and I. Frank's been on it, I couldn't tell you how many years, but he's been very dedicated in research, too, and the writing, and like I said, me, 13, and Scott, 30 years. You become so engaged in it, and as you're following the leads in the treasure hunt, and you find something, sometimes it's so minuscule, but it tells you what the next thing is. So it's almost like a treasure hunt, but it can't be done over the internet, which a lot of research has done now. The internet, although it's a wonderful thing, it's also spoon-fed to you, and it's somebody's opinion sometimes, or you don't even know the person's name, or can you track to see if it's actually accurate. This type of research is a little bit different, that you have to travel a lot and you have to track down. And when somebody says they saw or did something, you have to go back and you have to make them credible too, which means, are they who they said they are? Were they in that place? I mean, there's just a lot of paperwork. And in that, we've got over 55,000 documents that lead us all the way around that. Boy, you got a long answer off that one, didn't you?
It's excellent, though. Now, you did have some help because there were other people who were doing the research. There was another book about this before you guys decided to tackle it, or while you tackled it, that also had interviews and had some of the people that you then followed up with who were still living. Quick question. How many people did you guys interview for this?
Oh, my gosh. And how many people all total did we interview for it? At least 30 people that we personally interviewed. But the pre-books that you mentioned, what's really great is we didn't even know about some of the other books before we started the research, and then came to some of the same conclusions, which is always a positive. You know, that just reinforces your work. And now one of the early researchers on this case is actually working with us. That's really exciting because we've got a team then, you know, and that means that everybody is in it to find the truth as opposed to ego.
Is it William Steinman?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay, this is the 86th book, UFO Crash at Aztec, A Well-Kept Secret. There's a whole lot of content that then you guys can dovetail into, and it gives you basically a good solid foundation, because you can question things that maybe that you think, well, how did you get this information, or is it valid, or is the person still alive? Who's your source? Some of the stuff that happened with sources, I think there's one, when I was doing my research here, and there was a video I saw on YouTube that talked about, there's still one source you guys have who wants to remain anonymous, at least
we,
one.
We actually have two. We've just got another one. Just since the book has come out, we've got another one.
There's a reason people want to stay anonymous. Steinman was saying that after he published his book, he and his wife were harassed.
Yeah, he went through some tough times based on this, his work.
If there weren't anything behind this, there would be no reason.
No, that's true. Although, you know, honestly, we've never had any issues. We've never had any issues.
I still think it's new, and that this stuff is, with all of the background and the people. There was another author that who is listed, Chris Evans, who wrote another book and gave you another, I guess, another piece of evidence or a line to follow with his research. There's some fascinating tangents that I could go off on 80 topics without ever even, you know, touching the center of this, which I think is why it takes somebody 30 years and 13 years and, you know, because this thing is deep.
Well, and just as you said, unlike just someone viewing or someone seeing a craft, which is certainly important, or someone, or physical evidence, in this case, it's a comprehensive case. We've got all of them. And again, I don't say that pridefully. It's really a blessing to be able to bring all of this together, but it does take considerable commitment.
You have officials, you have military, you have locals, you have families of people who were involved or, you know, associated with it. That's why I say it's deep. And plus, the scene is accessible. And one of the things I thought was really compelling was this: there's a cement block there that would have no business being in that area if it weren't for some purpose. And it's alluded that this purpose would have been to put a crane on to give it stability to be able to lift a heavy craft or something that, of substantial weight.
And even more than alluded to, we spoke to, Scott interviewed a gentleman that was in the military at the time, and he, when Scott visited with him, he said, "You will know you found the spot when you find a road that goes nowhere, and it leads up to a cement pad." And, you know, again, we had researchers come in and we had experts come in to tell us what else that pad could be used. There's oil field in the area, and we dug into it, and if it had been oil field related, it would have exploded. And the rebar in it is on or around 1945. So that means that it was, could very possibly have been 1948 when this happened. You know, we try not to make comments unless we can document it and follow through with it.
I want to ask Scott a question. 30 years is a long time. What was the trigger? What made this thing hold enough weight to say, "I'm not giving up"?
Oh, boy. A lot of things. I guess when we first, or when I first dug into it, I was kind of a one-man show. Giving a quick example, just walking up and down the main street in Aztec and talking to people about it. Oh, the first several people I talked about shrugged their shoulders, didn't know anything about what I was talking about. And then it got to the point a few said, "Oh, yeah, we've heard that story over the years. There's probably nothing to it." And then you start getting to the people that say, "Oh, yeah, that really happened, and you need to talk to so-and-so." And I think the more we dug into it, or the more I dug into it back then, it was finding that there was more and more people that believed it happened and pointed me in some directions that showed that there was definitely credibility to this event happening. From there, it led on to finding documents and whatnot.
Part of your research was vetting these people and meeting face to face. Who was the most compelling that convinced you that you really needed to stick with this and find out as much as you could?
I think everyone that we interviewed played a part in that. Doug Nolan, who I talked to several times over the phone before he passed away. Ken Farley, who I flew out to Phoenix to interview, and he was at the crash site as a very young man. Then 99 or 2000, meeting the Air Force officer that we refer to as George in the book, who, by the way, is pretty well known by several other researchers that we shared the information with his blessing, by the way, just so we had credibility that there really was this person. The one thing that I think amazed me is they all told the same story, even though in Ken Farley's story, he didn't even know anybody there. He was simply, as a young man, passing through Aztec. So it wasn't like he knew Doug Noland or he knew this person or that person. He didn't know anybody. After the military released him, they got in their car and kept going to San Diego. And the other thing I think that really amazed me, and I don't know if this is coincidence or not, but these guys all went on to have very successful lives. And as I've described it in the past with other conversations, it wasn't like we interviewed the town drunks. These guys all went on. Doug Nolan owned a very successful assay business. Ken Farley did very well. Just on and on. I mean, these guys all basically, without an exception, all became very successful business people.
For people who are listening and don't have the background, the Aztec UFO incident, what happened?
Well, on the morning of March 25th, several things were going on. Manuel Sandoval, who was a police officer part-time at night for Cuba, New Mexico, which is roughly 100 miles southeast of Aztec, he was patrolling, and for several nights, if not several weeks, he had been seeing flying saucers. And New Mexico Highway Patrolman Andy Andrews, who was based in Farmington and his route would take him all the way down to Lybrook, he and Manuel Sandoval started comparing notes on what they were seeing at night. Well, we get to the morning of March 25th in the wee hours, Manuel Sandoval sees a very large craft that appears to be fluttering or as it's in trouble, not flying in the same patterns that he and Andy Andrews had seen in previous nights. He decides to pursue it and follow it to see where it's going, which, by the way, we've reenacted that route several times. Now, right before 5 o'clock in the morning, Valentin Archuleta is down in Blanco on his ranch, and he is getting up at the wee hours to let his sheep out into the pasture. And as he's standing next to the barn looking at the gate, he hears what he thinks is a sonic boom, looks up, and in the twilight hours sees this very large craft out of control, and it glances off a mesa on the southwestern side of his ranch, and then kind of straightens out and goes due north toward what we call Heart Canyon, or what we refer to in the book as Heart Canyon. He goes down to the Blanco Mercantile and calls the Air Force to tell them, hey, one of your flying saucers that you guys in the Air Force have an interest in, I just hit my mesa and I think it's going down. Of course, they ask where. He said up toward Heart Canyon, and they promised to call him back, and they never do. Now, bringing all the players into the picture, but at about the same time, the El Paso Oil Company employees are getting a phone call that there's a fire out by their storage tanks out on Heart Canyon Road. You know, fire and oil storage tanks aren't a good thing, and they're redirected out there, and when they get out there, that's Doug Nolan and Bill Ferguson. Other employees have gotten there first saying, hey, look, the brush fire is way up on top of the mesa. It looks like a lightning strike. No danger at all to the drip tanks, but you need to come up there because there's something very fantastic laying up on the mesa. And they get up there, and this very large object, approximately 100 feet across, is laying at an angle on the mesa, and it's, as they described it to me, a lenticular disc, very thin cross-section, very large craft. And at that point, the oil field workers feel that this is a U.S. machine. This is a test plane or test bomber of some type, and they need to get into the craft to see if they can be of any assistance. So that's sort of how the story starts, and then there's a long story behind it.
Were these folks who were on the scene told that they couldn't talk about it?
Yes. The military arrived late morning, early afternoon. They were all segregated and talked to individually. In their little separate conference, the military said that this was of the utmost national security. They're not to discuss it with anybody. Not confirming it was a flying disc or denying what it was. Of course, they had seen the bodies at that point, so the young oil field workers had a pretty good idea that this wasn't one of ours.
When I'm reading the book and thinking, oh my gosh, because, you know, you wonder the size of a body, what would it look like? And Doug and Bill saw two small bodies. They're looking through a hole in the window about the size of a quarter, and they saw him slumped over something that was like a control panel. And the sun was coming up, so they had access, they had a view, and they could see. And this is compelling because it gives you some kind of a tangible or, you know, concrete vision of what they are looking at. It's not just, I saw a little green man out there in the body on the field. This is a perspective. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And the porthole, to use that term, they were probably 8 or 10 inches across, according to Doug. One had a hole in it about the size of a quarter. And that kind of puzzled them. The craft was virtually intact. Doug says, I don't recall seeing any damage to it whatsoever. Of course, it was laying at an angle in the silty dirt, but the only damage that, this is consistent throughout the whole interview process with the, were back then young kids and now, you know, full-grown adults, that the one porthole had a hole in the middle. Now, whether that had anything to do with the object coming down, I would think it did. And maybe it had something to do with the fact that the bodies looked like they had been exposed to extreme heat or extreme pressure. They appeared to be burned.
You've been doing this, as Suzanne said, 30 years. Has there been any point when you have felt intimidated or, I guess, uncomfortable with anything that you, or anyone that you've been talking to?
No, not at all. No. We get asked that question a lot. I know there's other people in the field of ufology that they feel their phones tapped or that their records are gone through or whatever. I think they have very creative minds, some of them.
Well, or there's something else going on. Have you ever had your own sighting?
You know, interesting. I may have seen the Keksberg object back in 65, December of 65. My godmother and I were walking. We lived in Pittsburgh at the time, up on Mount Washington. And my parents were at a function that night, and she was walking me to the store and then back to the house. And we saw the object that is a perfect description of Keksberg. It came over the city of Pittsburgh, made a hard right turn, and looked like, to me, my memory of it, like it happened yesterday, it was like a Roman candle, but it burned for a long time. And my godmother, who's still alive today, and she and I joke about it, she thought it was a Nike missile being launched, because Pittsburgh had several Nike missile bases around the city to protect the steel industry during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. So her immediate response was panic, like, oh my God, are we launching Nike missiles and why? But it was the one night I was allowed to stay up late and watch the news because it was such a ruckus in Pittsburgh that this big sighting took place over Pittsburgh. So that would be the closest, you know, that I've always been fascinated by the subject matter.
And having that experience, there's a curiosity factor of, okay, if there's anything to it, maybe I can find a piece of the equation.
Exactly.
You apparently were doing your research, and you and Suzanne connected because she had a radio show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So you guys have been married how long?
We're on our 13th year.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. She had me on the show to talk about the research, and then she had me back on the show to talk about the research, and 8 months later, we were married. So.
It's good research.
Yeah. She did some good research, I guess, or maybe some bad research.
Well, I tell you what, it does help to have somebody, something like this, of this magnitude, it helps to have somebody involved in it, especially when this kind of thing can be an obsession. And if you understand, you know, the interest of your partner, then you're a good, I think, grounding, because you need somebody to say, take a break.
Yeah, and we're a great team, and the addition of Frank Thayer several years ago has been fantastic. He's been just a great partner. And then Bill Steinman, who wrote the UFO Crash at Aztec, he's kind of come out of his hibernation, so to speak, and he's been helping us quite a bit on the research since about last May.
Talking with Scott Ramsey and Suzanne Ramsey. Again, this is from 2016. Their new book is coming out in fall of 2024. Sign up on their website to stay informed. TheAztecIncident.com.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free and provides a report with solutions based on over 650 million vehicle scans verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we can recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
This is a refresh of an interview I did with Scott Ramsey and Suzanne Ramsey about the Aztec UFO incident. The follow-up to that book is coming out this fall. The book, It Came to Earth at Aztec, New Mexico, revealed the recovery of a UFO, consolidating all of their research and the newest clues to the puzzle. There's a plaque Scott Ramsey installed at the site of the crash in 2007. It tells the story of the crash recovery. More will be revealed in the upcoming book. Here's the backstory and my interview with the Ramseys in 2016.
Author Scott Ramsey and Suzanne Ramsey have been working on this project. Scott for 30 years, Suzanne for 13. Frank Thayer is also along with this project as well, and he has an extensive background in journalism and education. Okay, before we get into what I think is a smoking gun in this book, Suzanne, have you ever had any kind of a UFO encounter experience yourself?
I have not. I was raised in a home where we were very knowledge-oriented, as was Scott. Our house was full of books, and at the age of, I don't know, I was young, grade school, and my mom had a copy of Frank Scully's book. This is such a coincidence, but We lived in South Dakota. We were from Chicago. We moved to South Dakota. She was reading this book, and it had to have been at least 10 years after the book was written. I don't know where the book came from, but we would sit around the table and talk about what we were reading or what we were doing, and she talked about the book. And years later, when they decided to move to a warmer climate from South Dakota, they chose Aztec because my mom said, this is where that case happened. It stuck with me all these years, and it's just got to be, you know, exciting to be able to be in that area. Now, we didn't talk a lot about UFOs or anything like that, but I guess I just never even considered that they didn't exist. So, but I have never seen one.
That in itself is an incredible, and I don't think it's a coincidence, synchronicity, that you would have had that book. Now, this is where I think the smoking gun is. In the information, and I'll just tell you from your book, Alphabet Soup, George Kohler and the Air Force Boys, I love the radio involvement. Because at one point, there's a little magical element when the men in black kind of special agents, they come in and they're wanting some information, interviews, and they want them to be turned over. They're trying to confiscate any kind of evidence. I think this was so brilliant. The quote is, fix up the recordings for the gentleman. And they do a little special fixing, and the whole thing kind of demagnetizes and disappears. Can you explain what this was about? Because this is something that a lot of people have drawn this, the element here, as that it could have been a hoax, and why his material didn't stand up, Scully's material didn't stand up. But you guys went back and got a transcript of this conversation with the Air Force boys.
You're real close. Actually, what happened was there was a gentleman, one of the people in the book that we talk about, that went and gave a speech in front of the University of Denver and talked about the UFOs. He was unidentified at the time. And it was supposed to be one of the scientists, but because the scientists were under so much pressure for letting this information out, they ended up having someone get up and do the talk. Related to all of this was a salesperson at a radio station, and there were several military officers that came and interviewed him and said, what happened? Do you know this person? And he kind of comes right back at them and challenges them about, what do you know about UFOs? And challenges them. It's very, very interesting. When they went to leave, they said, we know you were taping this. We want that copy of the tape. They talked to the engineer. The engineer takes and the salesperson says, I want you to fix it up, as you said. And so they gave him a demagged copy, meaning that it was blank. Well, they didn't realize that till they left. They kept a copy. They hid the copy. And during our research, we were able to find it in Scully's, not just the transcript. What's transcripted on there was what I typed. I mean, word for word, all pauses, everything. But it actually, we had the reel-to-reel tape with it on it.
Absolutely brilliant, the smoking gun.
But you know, Wendy, here's the deal. You have to be able to go back and take that time and track and see where each thing leads. The other issue is that I think is where the cover-up is described, is where Scully is about to write the book, and he is approached by someone who works with the San Francisco Chronicle, and J.P. Kahn. J.P.'s very wealthy and very interested in getting this story. J.P.'s never had to work a day in his life, and he tells the folks at the San Francisco Chronicle, I'll be able to buy this. Just give me some money, and you know, I'll just buy this. We'll get it from Scully, and we'll be able to write this book. Scully says, no, I've written lots of other books. I'm in the process of writing this. I'm doing it. I don't need you. Well, J.P. had shot off his mouth, talking to everyone, telling them that I got this in the bag. When he was rejected, he went about, in essence, defacing everyone that was associated with. And that's how the cover-up began. I mean, we've got papers that talk about with J. Edgar Hoover and their discussion with J.P. Kahn about this. It just goes so thick. And as you said, in one book, just like in one interview, you can't even cover up a fraction of it. We try to do our best in the book. But like you said, it is so multidimensional.
I like his name, too, the Kahn Man, only it's C-A-H-N, the Kahn Man.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it fits him to a T. He was just peeved, really peeved, and decided to go out and had a little vendetta. But the cool thing is that there were some other people involved, such as Scully's family. And so they knew some of the background, some of the names, and some of the context, you know, in terms of the paperwork that he just sat on.
Yeah, yeah. Some of that was in his effects at the University of Wyoming. It hadn't been opened in many, many years. Well, since they closed it, since they closed up his and he passed away, they put his research in there, and that was one of the places that we were able to find some of that information. But you can't just settle for something and say, oh, well, that's great. That's somebody told us this, so I guess that's the way it is. You know, that's really not the type of research that we've chosen to do.
What I think is fascinating is some of this stuff, such as the information that Scully had, he sat on it. He didn't try to go out and say, but I can prove it. I think in some of these cases, when we've been through it, we know that no proof is enough when you've got somebody out there that will go to the lengths that Khan did to say, and the wrath of Khan comes up too.
Yeah, isn't that funny? There is some synchronicity in things, isn't there?
Okay, there's a reason for these names. But it's just baffling that it could have this much depth and still, you know, people are not willing to do the legwork. And what it says, though, is to your credit, the 30 years and 13 years of extensive and excruciatingly tedious work pays off when you're willing to say, all right, what do we not know? Let's find it. Let's not just discount it because somebody else is poo-pooing it. Let's find it. And you have uncovered a tremendous amount of evidence. The thing I like is when you're tracking how the vehicle, the ship, the craft could have been moved and going through there, retracing that. What was that like? Because the video I saw showed Scott out there, you know, hoofing it, looking for the evidence and clues in the dirt. What did you find that you thought or you think is a compelling factor with all of this concrete evidence?
Well, in regards to moving the craft, is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Well, moving the craft, Scott approached me about that, and we felt like we, with the first book, that, well, we've pretty much got the information, and this is probably all we're ever going to come up with. And then one night over dinner, he said, you know, we really need to explore moving the craft. And I said, what do you mean? I mean, we've spent, you know, $600,000 on this, and you know, it's, you'll never be repaid for that. And I said, seriously, do we need to know that bad?
Uh-huh.
He said, well, because it would be very costly, and that's out of our pocket. And he said, well, we've done everything else that the skeptics could have addressed, and this is the one area that we've not. And it's very easy to say, how did you move a 100-foot craft? And so he was absolutely right, and I'm so glad that he brought it up and that we did do it, and we brought in an expert, a world expert, to help us in that. And we actually reenacted moving the craft and to see what would happen, what would take place if the roads at the time of the moving of it, you know, because it's very different today. So you have to go back to what type of transportation, what type of equipment, what type of roads were there at that time. And so,
The highways in there are totally different.
Yeah. And roads, period. So, you know, that was something that we had to track. And then in terms of physical evidence, you know, the fact that we didn't know that a pad or why that road was there, and that we had someone directly tell us, you will know when you found that, it explained it to us. And we were able to follow up on that. But this last March, a year ago, we were out in New Mexico, and we had for years been trying to locate where the crash, where Mr. Archuleta saw it hit the cliff and then continue on to where it landed. And we were not able to do that, and no one was able to do that. And it always was very frustrating. We felt like, gosh, it's just, we know it's there. And we were able to find it in last March. And I got to tell you.
So that's the picture? That's the picture that's in the book?
Yeah, it's a scrape. And I wish that you could see it in real life, because it just blows your mind. Is that what we had to do was look for the area. We knew approximately, but you're dealing with. Have you ever been out to New Mexico?
I have, but it's been Taos and that area.
All beautiful, but one thing is, it's all but like 2 or 3 days a year, you have 100% blue skies, all open skies, unlike most places in the country. And in this particular area, Mr. Archuleta, Valentine Archuleta, had just returned from the war, and he was a Bataan Death March survivor. So he had some chutzpah to him. You know what I mean? He was he was quite a person, and a pretty solid person. And his ranch, it's a vast ranch, and it's in a valley. And then there are cliffs and bluffs all surrounding that area. And so you're almost like in a pit. Not that quite, but that kind of at least gives you a visual. And as it hit the cliff and bluff, the cliffs and bluffs, we're not talking about miniature ones. We're talking about just where it hit on the cliff or bluff was about 120 feet high. And then if you're coming down from the top, probably 60 feet, I'm going to guess. So it scraped, and we had to look. There's a lot of sandstone out there. So we're out there climbing all around. It was difficult to get up there in the first place, but once we got there, we figured this has to be approximately. And once we got there, we had to look for something that would be volcanic rock as opposed to sandstone. There's tons of sandstone out there. But volcanic rock would cause sparks, which is when the craft hit, there were sparks. Sandstone would not. So again, you know, it's Scott had a broken rib, and he was out and a concussion. He was hanging prior to this. He's hanging out there on the cliff, and we're all searching in different places. And he comes back, and if I would have known that as his wife, there would have been some issues. I can see that hanging off a cliff.
Yeah.
And he felt like, and he's trying to take a picture, and he's, you know, we got up there and we're not prepared for what we were going to find. We didn't know what we'd have to do. And he found it, and he knew when he saw it, because it's, you know, it's how many years old? And if it were from nature, it would be vertical, and there would be, you know, water or something that caused that. And it would just, you know, there are some things that you have to rule in and out. It isn't just, oh, there's a scrape. You have to qualify it all the way through. You know, it's taken us on those types of adventures. So that's another type of physical evidence that we were able to document.
Well, I also like the fact that you include in the book, hey, if you are so compelled after you read the book to take a little tour up here, take a lot of food and water because you're going to be out there.
Yeah.
Like it's four wheel, okay? It's just fascinating, though, that this can happen and people are still saying, if something this big happened, how could the government keep it quiet for so long? And how, if they have bodies in the whole nine yards, then why are we unable to track and document that for public discourse? You know, for us to go over and say, hey, I want to know where the bodies are stored and all that. Why can't we do that?
I think, you know, and this is opinion. I feel like at the time that this went on, think about the Cold War, think about all this, what was going on in the world. I really believe genuinely that the military and the government was really trying to protect us and give us a leg up on technology. If we found something like that, we sure didn't want anybody else to know. So I think genuinely that there was good intentions. May not be what we want or we like, and it's hard to believe that we couldn't know that information today. But then think about this too. If they went back at this point and they said, well, yeah, Aztec was all true. Everything that you read about Aztec is true. Then that puts a shadow of doubt in all of our minds. Not like we don't already have them, but a shadow of doubt. They confess it. Then you say, well, if you could do that and hide that for this long, what else are you hiding? And then that opens up a whole new can of worms. And so, you know, I think, you know, we always try to be fair in this, in seeing both sides of what they probably are experiencing. There's some questions that, boy, we'd sure like to have answered.
And then that's my next question. Beyond this, the documentary that I saw, Scott was saying, I'm not done with this. So is there more?
That was before the first book. The first book we completed. Then due to the first book, we were able to gather more information. People came out of the woodwork And again, it takes sometimes years to qualify a person and to, you know, it's not just hearsay. Oddly enough, we have found, we really felt like, well, we don't have all the answers that we'd like, but it's probably the best we can possibly do when we put this book out. And son of a gun, if we didn't get, haven't had a couple more things. There was one item that I've really wanted to address, and we've just never been able to nail it prior to the new book coming out. But once the new book came out, we've been actually approached and have some really quality information. So I don't know where that will take us. You know, the whole focus is finding the truth. It's not trying to convince anybody. It's not trying to dissuade anybody. It's just, we just want the truth. And so I guess the quest goes on. We thought we were done.
And that's what Scott said. There's another anonymous person, because you have one, according to the book, there's at least one who still remains, who wants to be incognito. And then there was another one who has come out since this book, which I think is another chapter.
Yeah. And like I said, there's actually two or three now that we're working on, and we've got to qualify. So, and you never know where that will take you. You just don't. It's kind of, literally, it's just kind of a step of faith. You just kind of have to see where it takes you and then where it builds you.
There's one more thing that you could bring to the table if you could ever get your hands on it that is said to exist, and that's photos of the crash site.
Yeah. If you've got them, Wendy, I'm in.
Okay, we'll put the word out now. Me and my ET friends are going to say, okay, let's convince somebody it's time to turn them over, all right?
You know what? I'd be thrilled. I know Scott and I would probably, Frank, we'd probably, oh my gosh. We'd throw a heck of a party.
Well, they're in a little metal file box somewhere, just like Mr. Scully, who ferreted his stuff away, even though there was plenty of opportunity for him to say, well, look, I've got this, end of story. He said, if you wanted to find out, do a little more research, kids. I'm done.
Yeah. Well, to Scully's credit, when he said, I promise that I will not disclose this information, he never did. He took it to his deathbed. You know, that's really, you have to, as frustrating
integrity
as it is to us, we also are really, I respect him a lot for that.
Yeah. Well, that's integrity. That's a guy you want to tell your story to because you know your secrets are safe with him.
Yeah, I think that's why they chose him. I really do.
I believe your story lays a whole lot of wonderful foundation and credible evidence out for public discourse. You know, if you have a question about UFO researchers and what they do and why they're compelled to try and dot the I's and cross the T's beyond a shadow of a doubt, this book is a really nice piece of homework that says that the Aztec UFO incident was a reality. And there are a lot of people who saw, who were there, who were part of that experience. What's the next move for you guys?
Follow through with the continued research. The search goes on. And to qualify these latest leads, and boy, it takes it in a whole different, on top of that direction. I mean, it gives you just even more information and confirmation.
Oh, that's a tease.
Yeah, it's a tease, believe me. We go to bed at night every night with that tease. We have people say to us, can you tell us where the bodies came from, or ask us questions like that? And my statements always are, good God, we spent 30 years just trying to document that the event happened. Give us a break.
Credit goes to the authors and their research, Scott Ramsey, Suzanne Ramsey, and Frank Thayer. Details about the crash available on their website, theaztecincident.com. And the new book, It Came to Earth at Aztec, New Mexico, revealed the recovery of a UFO. Thanks for listening.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.